Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Today we tackle an important subject which we've shamefully not touched before, probation. Rob Allen and I are joined by Julie Eden-Barnard, a lecturer in community justice at De Montfort University, and David Shipley, a former prisoner who writes and speaks on prison and justice issues. Rob, the probation service in England and Wales has been subject to some huge changes in the last 20 or 30 years. Can you just briefly take us through some of those?
I'll mention just two. I've always thought of probation as somehow sitting somewhere between social work on the one hand and policing on the other. And in recent times, I think it's definitely moved towards the policing end of that spectrum, less emphasis on helping offenders through forming supportive relationships with them, more on enforcing conditions and requirements. The other thing is how the service is organised. It's really been pushed from pillar to post over the last 20 or 30 years. It was a local service. It's now a national service. We had this, fortunately, short-lived period when private companies provided most probation supervision. And arguably, probation is still recovering from what was really an ill-fated experiment.
Yeah, that was the Grayling experiment, wasn't it? David, you recently blogged about your experience of being supervised by probation after coming out of prison. What did the aim of that supervision seem to be?
You know, I spent over 2 years on probation being supervised, and I don't think I at any point had a clear idea of what it was for. Every few weeks, I'd go and meet with a probation officer. It was usually someone different, and they'd ask me the same rote list of questions. You know, have you committed a crime? Have you been taking drugs? Have you been drinking? You know, how's your mental health? And I'd be out in 10 minutes every time. It felt like it was a process of box ticking, rather than any substantive effort to engage with me as a human being or try to minimise my risk of reoffending.
But presumably from the kind of questions they were asking, they were keen to keep you on the straight and narrow?
Yes, I think there seemed to be a fixation about asking questions around those sorts of issues. I did wonder a lot who would answer yes. You know, would anyone reasonably go in and go, yes, I've been taking lots of drugs, I've committed loads of crimes, you know, please help me. Because I think the reality of the power dynamic with a probation officer and someone who's on probation is that you're always afraid that they might use their power to recall you to prison. So there's a strong bias against being honest with them.
Yeah, just to clarify for everyone, there's a system by which a lot of prisoners are released, and if they transgress, it's not necessarily commit another crime, but if they don't turn up for an appointment or they're found drunk or something like that, they can be sent back into prison to serve more time there.
Mm. Julie, you worked as a probation officer. I mean, the original role of probation was really to advise, assist and befriend. Is that still what probation is supposed to be doing?
In short, no. I have a bit of a conflict about advise, assist, befriend, because I think it's kind of used a lot to signal a past that people would like to go back to. And I think that advise and assist has connotations for me about doing something to someone, not working alongside them. So I don't particularly like advise and assist. And I don't think befriend accurately captures the quality of a good working relationship either. So I'm not sure that I would like to go back. I have had the absolute privilege of working with Professor Robert Canton, and he talks more about working with fairness, working respectfully, encouraging people and having a personal interest in the people that we're working with. And for me, those values much better capture what I would deem to be important in terms of probation practice, far better than advise, assist, befriend.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I mean, that was the phrase in the Probation Act in 1907 or whenever it was. But I suppose it captures an approach which is really about trying to get alongside somebody and help them solve their problems and help them stay out of prison, fundamentally. I mean, has probation still got that at its core, do you think?
I think that probation is really conflictive. And David, I read your blog post and there were so many themes in there that I would agree with. And I've always felt that as practitioners, we are trying to work within a system that doesn't always support us to do what we would like to do. So I think if you speak to individual probation officers, they are there because they deeply care and they want to help and support and make a difference in people's lives. But they're working within a punitive system. So as David so eloquently talked about, this power dynamic, I think if you're a good probation officer, you're acutely aware of that power dynamic and wanting to use power legitimately. And if you're not a great practitioner, I think there's a structure that exists that enables you to hide out a little bit. And in terms of what makes someone a good practitioner, I really think that it's those skills to have empathy, to show kindness, to relate to each other as people, to care about what that person's individual circumstances are like.
Yeah, I think the point you just made about a personal interest is key. When I think about the probation officers I encountered, there's only one who really stands out as being great. And she genuinely took a personal interest in me. She even helped me through her personal network to find lecturing work at university, and she quite soon moved on to go and become a clinical psychologist. And I do recognize that most probation officers go into the job because they want to help, and I think it is the system that makes things tough for them. But the sense I got was of really overstretched probation officers with little time, you know, no real time to even read the file notes, let alone get to know the person they were meeting for the first and probably last time. And I think more widely, there's this issue that the probation service is very risk management focused now, particularly with the concerns about serious further offences. So I think if you look at the recalls, three quarters of recalls are not for reoffending. They're for something that's indicated an increase in risk, which may be as simple as missing appointments. And I think that very punitive approach by nature must make it really hard for most people on probation to trust most probation officers.
Yeah, I mean, David, you wrote in your blog, I think, that your probation appointments actually made your mental health worse. Can you give us an example of how that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's something very tough about the period when you've been released from prison and you're being supervised by a probation officer, because your sentence is still ongoing. And in all that time, if probation decide you can be recalled to prison for a couple of weeks, a month, or even the rest of your sentence. And that experience is intensely stressful. And when I speak to friends of mine who I met in prison, and when I think about my own experience, there's all these common notes. So I think we all find the sounds of sirens intensely triggering. We all find the experience of going to see probation intensely triggering, because every single time it functions as a reminder of the fact that you are at the mercy of the justice system, the mercy of the state still, and that your sentence hasn't finished. So I personally would find every time I had a probation meeting, on every occasion, I had done nothing to increase my risk. You know, I've never missed an appointment, never, you know, committed another crime. And yet I still felt incredibly anxious about it. And then afterwards, you know, after this brief meeting where I had to answer the same rote questions, I would then go home and feel crushed. And I typically spend the next day not leaving the house, feeling very, very flat, unable to go out into public, which was very strange because, you know, there was nothing particular that the probation officers did which made me feel anxious. But I think the dynamic of the situation itself is inherently one in which you feel very powerless and very exposed.
Julie, do you recognise that dynamic?
Yeah, I will say that I left practice in early 2019 and towards the end of my time in practice was working in a community rehabilitation company.
Which is one of the private companies that was set up.
Yes. So what I'm about to say maybe has changed and is not reflective of current situations. But if I think about what I would have been allocated in terms of my workload for somebody who was low risk, it was probably equated to about 10 minutes a week. You know, and that's everything. That's any kind of referrals that you need to do, any updates to risk assessments. That's the contact time that you have with somebody. So if you think that David's reporting on like a monthly basis, that 10 minutes a week is very quickly eaten up. And I think that probation officers fight really, really hard to make sure that the contact that they're having with people is meaningful. But it's in the context that many, many probation officers are working over their 100% workload and have been for a long time. If we took away the unpaid labour that probation officers undertake, I think the service would collapse. And it's been that way for a long time. But the consequence of that is that David experiences, you know, although people were pleasant, there was no meaningful connection. And I think the sad thing is that most probation officers would not like to practice in that way.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, my experience of being on probation in 2021 through to 2023 and of inspecting probation in 2022 was that this is a common theme everywhere. There are staff who are far too stretched. You have no time to really engage with the people they're supervising in a detailed way. And that's strange because, you know, the government commissioned a longitudinal study in 2009, 2010, where they actually looked at what kind of probation supervision actually brings down reoffending. And the finding was very clear. It's not lots and lots of meetings. It's high quality conversations and high quality meetings. And yet we still have a model under which probation officers have to see people once a week or once a month, when in fact it would probably make a lot more sense, you know, to see them less often, but actually have a real conversation, you know, sit down with them for half an hour and really talk through stuff and get to understand them.
Yeah, I mean, Julie, you mentioned you worked for a community rehabilitation company. I mean, how far do you think that whole privatisation experience damaged the ability of probation officers to make relationships? Or do you think that's a sort of a factor that's to do with other things, workloads, however it's organised?
I feel really conflicted about it, actually, because in terms of my value base, I was absolutely opposed to the privatisation of a public service. I think public services should be public. In relation to then my experience of practice, not being part of the National Probation Service gave us a level of flexibility to be responsive to the needs of the people that we were working with. So that was a flexibility that I don't think we would have had as part of the National Probation Service. The company that I worked for really embedded a desistance-based approach. So looking at what people are good at, or looking at what skills they have, looking at their networks, and looking at how we build on those strengths rather than kind of looking at problems that are located within the individual.
So it sounds like the privatisation did allow for some more innovation and some more kind of constructive approaches than the traditional one. So, David, did this privatisation affect you at all in your experience, or have you got any views about how it worked?
When I was released, the probation system had switched back to being publicly run, but only recently. The privatised model obviously had a lot of failings, and I think I'm, on balance, opposed to it. I'm not sure what we've replaced it with is great either, though, because we've made probation officers into civil servants instead of professionals like teachers or doctors. And what that means is they're not really free to talk about issues in the system. The probation service is now part of the Ministry of Justice. You know, anyone who's working as a probation officer is bound not to speak to the media in the same way that any civil servant is bound. And my view, having worked as a consultant probation and prison inspector, is that the rest of the Ministry of Justice looks down a bit on the probation service. So within prisons, there are probation officers who work within prisons. What was very clear from going into prisons and inspecting was that those probation officers were treated almost like the enemy in many cases by prison staff. They were shut out of conversations, they were ignored, they were almost sort of pushed out the door rather than allowed to engage with the people they were supposed to be supervising. So I'm not sure it's in the interests of the probation service or the people who it supervises to have it as part of the Ministry of Justice.
That sounds extraordinary. Why do you think that was? I mean, there surely everybody working with people in prison is trying to ensure that when they leave, they don't come back. And so why this hostility?
I think that's probably how we'd all like to imagine the justice system working. In reality, in my experience, often there are very different attitudes. So there's many people who work in prisons, not just prison officers, but probably mostly prison officers, who I think take an attitude that I would characterise as, you know, they're all villains. and who have a very cynical attitude to the people in their custody. And that can often be exhibited in an assumption that any request for support, be it mental health, physical health, assistance with communication, is the prisoner trying to pull a fast one. And in that kind of culture, probation staff who often come at it from a more compassionate perspective, I think there can be a real culture clash there. And prison staff can see probation staff within prisons as being too soft-hearted or not being sufficiently cynical about the people they're working with.
Julie, what do you think? I mean, obviously you had a relatively good experience with the private CRC. Have you got any views about the new way that probation is being dealt with as probation officers, as civil servants? Because in the old days, as Rob said, they were local practitioners, weren't they?
Yeah. And also, if you go back and read accounts where people talk about joining probation in, you know, 70s, 80s, what I get from reading that is that people have a strong sense of social justice, and that's really key and really significant in why they've chosen to be part of the probation service. So again, I find myself agreeing with David that one of the consequences of then being part of the civil service is that I think it really has oppressed probation's political voice. People aren't able to speak out about social justice issues that they believe very passionately in. Where I practiced locally, we had no NAPO, so that's the National Association of Probation Officers. We had no representatives that were working within the community rehabilitation company. So again, I think over time, we've seen our political voice through our union diluted. And I think that's concerning.
Julie, in the USA, there's a growing movement amongst academics, in fact, and reformers to look at reducing the role of probation, as it were, almost defunding probation, because they're concerned that it pushes people back into prison rather than keeping them out. Do you think that's a risk here too?
I've definitely always practiced if people don't turn up for a planned appointment, then a warning letter is issued. Somebody has 7 days to provide evidence of that absence. If they can't do that, then it's deemed to be an unacceptable absence. Two unacceptable absences mean that you take enforcement proceedings. So that could be returning the court order back to court for breach proceedings, or it could be looking at recall to custody. And again, I think that a lot of practitioners would say most of the time when people don't turn up, they can't provide evidence. So I have a level of professional judgment and I can look at the circumstances and decide whether I accept that absence or not. I think most reasonable people would try and rearrange appointments. I think it's really important to also then look at the most recent serious further offence cases, particularly the Damien Bendel case. One of the criticisms there is that he didn't attend an appointment post-release and that enforcement action wasn't taken quickly enough. And if it had been taken, then perhaps he wouldn't have been able to commit the offences that he did.
He committed murder, didn't he? After his release, yeah.
Yeah. But I think my point there is just that people are living within a culture of fear, that although we've got this professional discretion available to us, if things go wrong, ultimately that could be your job on the line. And yes, people are in this job because they care, but ultimately people are there because they want to put a roof over their head and food on the table. And so I think that that demonstrates really, really well the kind of conflicts that probation officers are in on a daily basis. And the whole point of risk and risk assessment is that it's guesswork, you know, based on the best available knowledge that we have at the time. But we're trying to make predictable the unpredictable. And I think that that's really hard to work within sometimes. I think if we look at the wider context, we've lost a lot of experience within teams. And it might be now that senior probation officers are managing teams that are made up of predominantly people undertaking their probation officer training, or very newly qualified members of staff. So the experience isn't there to learn from.
I agree with almost everything you've just said, Julie. I think in the case of serious further offences, when we investigate them, I think we tend to focus on what can be measured. So we measure missed appointments. There was a missed appointment. Therefore, that must be the problem. And I think it's much easier to fixate on breaches of process than try to understand what actually might drive someone to commit you know, a horrendous further offence and didn't commit murder. The other aspect of this, which I think sometimes gets unremarked, is these are bureaucratic processes designed primarily by people with university degrees who have fairly stable lives. And therefore, those designers of these processes might say, well, you know, someone can't possibly miss three appointments. You know, that's ridiculous. Of course, you make it one of three appointments. But often people who've recently been released from prison are in a profound state of chaos. You know, for all of the horrors of prison, it does provide stability and you don't need to worry about housing yourself or eating. People are released often without a job. We release a lot of people from prison without anywhere to live. And in that context, where people are struggling just to keep their heads above water, it is actually quite easy to see how someone might miss one or more appointments. And I think the designers of these processes and systems sometimes need to extend a greater sense of empathy and try to understand the reality of the lives of the people who these rules apply to. Penelope, you also asked about the US system and what lessons we could learn from that. My understanding of the US probation system, it has a number of characteristics which don't apply here. For example, people on probation there have to pay for the probation officer.
They do.
And failing to pay the probation officer's fees is also a grounds for recall to prison. So I think it's a very, very different system, and I'm not sure how much we can learn from it. You know, what we do know from research is that certain models of probation do seem to help people be less likely to reoffend, but they are around high quality interactions, building real relationships. You know, I think what Julie said about trying to identify for each individual what might help them become a happier, you know, more pro-social, more positive person who can choose a life which steps away from crime.
Yeah. Can we just sort of take a step back? Can I ask you, David, when you were in prison, did you meet some people who had been recalled, who had been sent back by probation officers for failing to comply with their conditions after they'd been released or not?
Yes, all the time. When I was in Wandsworth Prison, where I spent about half of my sentence, people were in for recall often. I remember one man I shared a cell with who had a short sentence in the first place. I think his sentence was 3 or 4 months. He'd been released halfway through that. He then breached his probation conditions and been recalled for 2 weeks. And short sentences do a great deal of harm and very little good anyway. To, on top of that, call someone back to prison for 2 weeks, you know, all that you achieve by doing that is ensuring that they'll lose any employment they'd found. They might lose their home. And you've thrown their life into more chaos. And these sorts of very short recalls, I think, are not only entirely punitive, they're actually really counterproductive, because we know that if people have a job, good community ties, good family ties, something positive to focus on, they are less likely to commit more crime. Calling them back to prison for these short terms is doing the exact opposite of that. It's just throwing lives into chaos.
Mm. So you'd say that there are plenty of people who get recalled who really don't need to be and shouldn't be?
I believe so, yes.
Can you think of any examples of, you know, just stupid things that people did which got them recalled?
Often it is missing appointments. You know, there were people who'd gone to the wrong area, breached some condition of their license. Sometimes, though, you encounter bureaucratically bizarre situations. So when I was inspecting prisons, I encountered a guy who was about 2 weeks away from release. And he had just been given his license conditions, i.e. the conditions under which he would be released to the community to be supervised by probation. And they were bizarre. He had been told that he wasn't allowed to visit or live in a particular area, but also he was told that that's where he had to go for his probation meeting. So as it stood, according to the paperwork, on the day of his release, he would be required to attend a meeting in an area which he was not allowed to go to. And if he didn't attend the meeting, he could be recalled to prison. But equally, if he breached his license conditions by going to that area, he could be recalled to prison.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? It's a sort of catch-22, if there ever was one.
Absolutely. So, Julie, we've talked about recall and the problems there, and you've talked about the problems of probation in general. You're now teaching new probation recruits. Does that make you more optimistic?
Again, that is something that I feel really conflicted about, because I work with people that either have just joined the service or they've been in the service for quite a long period of time and are undertaking the training to become a qualified probation officer. And so there is an optimism about what they're undertaking. I don't think I could work within the probation service anymore. I strongly believe in the work that probation do in terms of help and support. I've really struggled to work within the constraints of that organisationally, and for most of my career felt that I struggled to find my authentic voice as a practitioner because I felt that I was kind of working in spite of a system. And I think that a lot of practitioners feel that.
My sense from speaking to friends who are still being supervised by probation and from having off the record conversations with currently working probation officers is that the whole system is really struggling. The probation service is struggling to retain good, experienced staff. The recall rate keeps going up. So more and more people are being recalled to prison, and we should see that as a failure. The probation service's job is to keep people out of prison, not to send them back, and yet that recall rate keeps rising. And the general tenor of the conversations I have with people who are working as probation officers now is that the management culture has become entirely focused on risk management. The aim is simply to avoid serious further offences, to do everything possible to protect against career risk, fundamentally. And that kind of management culture, I believe, is going to crush anyone who comes into the probation service with really, you know, enthusiastic dreams and hopes of changing lives for the better, because that kind of bureaucratic approach is entirely inimical to those sort of noble goals.
Mm. But speaking personally, you have now finished with probation, or you don't have anything at the moment to do with them, other than as a sort of a keen observer, I guess.
That's right. So my period under licence finished in November of last year, and that was after just over 2 years of supervision.
That is a long time. Do you think supervising somebody presumably low risk like you for 2 years, there's much point in that?
This is a really good question. I think we have to ask, though, what would happen if we didn't have these extended periods of supervision? And I think the reality is it would be very, very difficult to persuade the British public that actually we should just substantially reduce sentences. You know, I suspect the alternative to lengthy periods on probation would not be shorter sentences. It would be people spending more time in prison. So I think we have to be realistic about it. And obviously, as I've said, you know, my experience of being on probation was pretty affecting for my emotional health and not very pleasant. But I did keep telling myself, well, this is better than being in prison. And I think it's important if you're someone who's, you know, experiencing the justice system to try to keep a sense of perspective. So when I was in an open prison, I always said, well, this is better than, you know, better than a closed prison. When I was out on tag with an ankle bracelet, I kept telling myself that was better than being in prison. And similarly, having to attend a probation meeting once a month was much, much better than still being in prison. So I think there probably wasn't much point in me being supervised for that long. And I suspect that's true for many people. But realistically, I'm not sure what an alternative would look like given the prevailing views of the electorate in this country and of politicians.
Well, thanks for a fascinating conversation. We have to draw to a close, sadly. And we do that by asking each of you in turn to suggest something to try and improve the system. If you were in charge, Secretary of State for Justice, what one thing would you do to improve the probation system in this country? Julie?
Given the current situation of the probation service, I think that the one thing could be about the reintroduction of a senior practitioner role at an enhanced probation officer salary with a caseload, but a very protected caseload, specifically to try and encourage people who have recently left probation to come back so that probation can once again benefit from that expertise that is currently lost because those people have gone. I think there are lots of people like me that being a probation officer is really, really strong part of their identity, and that people have gone into it because it's a vocation that they care very deeply for. And I think rather than investing lots of time and energy into recruiting brand new people, we're missing a trick in terms of the experience that is out there.
What about you, David?
I'm afraid I'd propose a big change, which might be quite disruptive for the probation service, but I would look to return to the old model where probation was embedded in a local community and where a person in prison would have the same probation officer all the way through their time in prison and then on release. The result of that is you get really genuine, deep, trusting relationships, which we know are one of the biggest drivers of a successful outcome for probation supervision. Now, that would mean a huge root and branch reform of probation yet again, but I think returning probation to a local function akin to social services, which is embedded in the community, could make a huge positive difference.
And Rob, you're a localist. Would that be your option? Or if you were Secretary of State for Justice, what would you do?
Well, I think I'd go a bit further, actually. There's 20-odd years ago, there was this big reform to youth justice, which brought together agencies, different organisations in youth offending teams, health, education, social work, police, probation. I think we need those different organisations working together locally to give the best possible outcomes for people who need supervision and support.
Thanks, Rob, David and Julie. And do refer to the programme notes for David's excellent article, Julie's work and our report on the localisation of criminal justice services. And do feed us any ideas for future podcasts or guests. Bye.